Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. All of us have dark secrets in our family. What if you could tell that there was something really dark buried in the past that your parents, aunts, and uncles would never talk about, but it was this elephant in the room whenever you got together? Well, what if you found out that your grandparents were involved in the Third Reich? Not only that, but they were enthusiastic members of the SS. Well, today I'm talking with author Julie Lindell, who had exactly that experience. Julie's a historian of 20th century Europe, and she began to uncover her family's past when she was looking in the archives. Her new book is called The Pendulum, A Granddaughter's Search for Her Family's Forbidden Nazi Past. In this work, she explored her family's grief, confusion, and secrecy concerning the responsibility of her grandparents for the enslavement, torture, and murder of the local population in occupied Poland. Julie went on a six-year journey through Germany, Poland, and then to South America, where her grandparents later went in the early 1960s, and found family members she didn't even know about in Paraguay and Brazil. She uncovers, among many other discoveries, that her grandfather had been a fanatic member of the SS since 1934. During World War II, he was responsible for enslavement and torture and was complicit in the murder of the local population on the largest states he oversaw in occupied Poland. And in her research, she encountered villagers in Poland who directly suffered by her grandfather and tries to grapple with how to come to terms with a past that includes your own family members but is also very dark. So we get into a lot in this discussion: how Julie put together the story, how she discovered it, how her family members reacted when she revealed it, but also, how do you take these lessons from history and understand all the complexity when sometimes your own family members can be indicted in a bad story, but still try to get positive lessons about what to do in the future? I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Julie Lindell. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We have a lot to talk about. You have a fascinating story, and this is a story I haven't heard on this podcast before. I don't think my listeners have heard a story quite like this before of having a family member involved in the SS. So we're all going to hear your full story of how you got the full story and got into the archives. But before we get into that, what was the first inkling that you got that your grandparents were involved with the SS? Was it family lore that you heard? Was it something you found in the archives?
Well, I think the very first inkling I had was when I was a student of international affairs at Oxford University and happened to choose Polish-German relations in the 20th century as my subject matter. And, you know, my family had never mentioned anything about this history, so there was no personal reason for me to choose that subject. But as I was deepening myself in the in what took place in Poland under the Third Reich and in occupied Poland during the war, I started to put two and two together. I was born in Brazil in 1967. My mother was born in occupied Poland in 1941, and my grandparents went to Brazil in the years after the war. And so I started to get an idea that perhaps my grandfather had been a perpetrator. Now, I didn't know that he was in the SS. That information came later on when I went to the German Federal Archives in April 2010, basically driven by desperation to know the truth because no one would tell me. But I must say that through the years of conversations with my German grandmother, who I love to spend time with, who I shared many interests with, I started to sense that perhaps this was the case and perhaps they just simply were not sharing the full story of what they had been doing in Poland during the war with me.
Before we get into the full story of what they were doing, first, could you paint the picture of what's happening historically? First, what was daily life like in Nazi-occupied Poland, you know, relationships between Poles and Nazis? And second, can you describe rat lines, what they called, how high-ranking Nazi officers, we always think of generals like Joseph Goebbels, going to South America and how that process worked?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's start with what life was like in occupied Poland. My grandparents were stationed in West Central Poland, so an area called the Wartegau, which was what the Nazis named the Central Western Province. What they made into a province, a new province of Germany, after they invaded. And this area, and indeed most of occupied Poland, was really what you could say a greenhouse for the SS's ideas. And of course, their primary idea was to create what they saw as a racially pure Germany, where Germans had plenty of living space. And so really, my grandparents were stationed in an area where the SS hatched all their worst ideas. And, among them, of course, the concentration camps, but also the way that they waged their racial war. I mean, the tone was set in occupied Poland, and my grandfather was likely a part of he may have been a member of one of the mounted police squadrons that came in after the initial invasion by the German army, which really were pumped full of this propaganda about the racial struggle and set the dreadful tone of the war. Maybe I should say something also about the relationship between Germans and Poles right. Before I go on to the Latin American piece, because really the head of the Nazi head of the Wartegau, so this new German province, a man called Arthur Greiser, made some very well known speeches in which he called Poles the servants of Germans, so that they were good for nothing more than for being servants. Actually, the idea was not to have Poles remain in Poland, certainly not in any part of the Wartegau, but to let them die out or to get rid of them, to deport them, and to bring in ethnic Germans from the East. So there were people who regarded themselves as ethnically German who lived in different parts of Eastern Europe and even Russia, who were supposed to be welcomed back into the Reich, there were big signs saying "Welcome back to the Reich" in this area of Poland. But Poles were regarded as degenerate, and they were supposed to be wiped out in the end. So Slavs in general were regarded as a degenerate race by Hitler, which was actually one of his biggest mistakes, because it was because of his view of Slavs that he actually ventured to invade the Soviet Union. He viewed them as being weak and unable to stand up to his army. And of course, as we know today, he was quite wrong about that.
One other question for your grandparents. Were they of ethnic German background or were they of Polish background?
No, they were from Northern Germany.
Oh, okay.
Now, we haven't done any DNA tests on them, so we don't know, right. We don't know where they actually came from. That always delivers a few surprises, but they came from Northern Germany. They came from Schleswig-Holstein, and that's where they returned after the war. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that when they returned to Schleswig-Holstein after the war, they called themselves refugees. In order to benefit from the system for helping refugees after the war, and I guess in order to sort of partly garner sympathy, but they were not in fact refugees, because they came from the West. You know, they came from Schleswig-Holstein. So, yes, there were Germans who lived in Western Poland who were there during that time, and they tended to be. It was mixed, but they tended also to be a little bit more difficult, at least in the early, at least towards the late 30s. Germans who had, you know, lived in that western part of Poland, it was harder to kind of persuade them to see Poles as degenerate because they were exposed to them and they lived in this kind of middle zone between two cultures. So, so about the Latin American question you had about the rat lions.
Yes.
And your question, I guess, was how it was that these people, former SS, made their way to Latin America. Is that right?
Yeah, because I know about the high-profile cases in the immediate aftermath of the war, but I didn't know that this was still happening in the 1960s. I was surprised to hear that.
Yes, we know that there were many who fled. There were some who even made their arrangements during the war already to flee to Latin America, where they knew they would find a sympathetic, ideologically sympathetic environment. This continued throughout the post-war period. Now, my grandparents left Germany in December 1960. And if you think about what was going on at that time, I was, of course, told that, therefore, their departure for Latin America had nothing to do with what had taken, what they had done during the war or what they had participated in during the war. But a little closer look at history actually revealed quite the opposite. In 1958, in the German Federal Republic, the first new wave of war crimes trials started. And so the reason that these began again after Nuremberg was because the United States and Israel brought pressure to bear on the young West Germany, on Chancellor Adenauer. And this was because of the Cold War. They needed to have, or at least from the United States point of view, less from Israel's. Israel was, of course, simply seeking justice, which is completely understandable. But the United States needed to have a strong West Germany in the middle of Europe and could not afford to have the accusations by the new East Germany that the West German state was simply a continuation of, you know, the Third Reich, that it was full of fascists running around free, which to some extent was true, because most former SS had been pardoned and were let off fairly lightly, in the late 40s because of the emergence of the Cold War. So these people were sitting in positions of power in politics, in schools, in local government, and this situation was intolerable. So Adenauer allowed the opening of new war crimes trials, and the first one took place in Ulm. And the outcome of that trial was that it was no longer, you were no longer let off the hook if you argued that you had simply followed orders.
Hmm.
So, and of course, this was a real wake-up call to quite a lot of SS who had most of the time argued that, well, it wasn't, I would never have done it had I not been required to follow orders. And in fact, my grandmother often said that, you know, if my grandfather hadn't followed orders, he would have been strung up. But that actually wasn't strictly the case. So anyway, that whole argument fell apart. And after that, a federal prosecutor's office was established in Ludwigsburg in the same year, 1958. And this also worried a lot of former SS because now it meant that the German government was going to prosecute war criminals. And so it was really the beginning of a new era. And so finally, when Adolf Eichmann was captured in Buenos Aires in May 1960, this really rung the alarm bells through former SS communities because it was fairly clear from the beginning that he was going to be put on trial by the Israelis. And many people wondered, that is among former SS circles, who he was going to name in this trial.
Right.
So many of them started to make other arrangements. And my grandfather happened to have some, during my research, I identified another former SS who had fled earlier, so who had fled towards the end of the 40s to Brazil. and who he kept contact with, and who at that time helped him and his wife to find a place to go to in this new hostile climate. I mean, the links to the networks between former SS at that time, they've been portrayed in the movies as a little over-exaggerated, you know, that they were somehow planning to kind of bring back the Third Reich at some point, that they were reorganizing themselves to kind of hijack the West German government. I don't think that's a stretch of the imagination, but they certainly had quite close networks, and they certainly helped one another.
Well, thank you for that description. And I have one more question. I did a short podcast episode on the movement of Nazi generals to South America in the 1940s. And the Catholic Church was involved. If you take the pro-Catholic view, they were just helping Catholics who were going to come under the Soviet Union and giving them a way to escape from that. If you take the much less sympathetic Catholic view, the Catholic Church had been very cozy with fascist governments in Italy and Spain and may have had sympathies with these Nazi generals. So that's how ratlines work in the 40s. But in the 60s, what was the process by which you would leave? Would you simply use your passport and get a ship or a plane to South America and hope that you could leave before people started asking questions? Or was there more of a, I don't know, coyote smuggling process?
I think the smuggling happened earlier. Those were the earlier waves, of people who got out. And the later ones were, in my grandfather's case, he wasn't being pursued at that particular moment in time, but he certainly became quite worried that he would be pursued. And so my grandparents were able to leave, on a French cruise liner out of Hamburg. But there were all sorts of creative ways. I think a lot of work has been done on this by Gerald Steinacher, who wrote Nazis on the Run, who actually tried to trace the various ways that people got out. But I would say that, through the 50s and into the late 50s and 60s, it was possible for people to, put their things together and leave as long as they had, some sort of link or network on the other end. They were given advice as to how to do things in a fairly smooth manner and got out. And the other thing was that, it wasn't that my grandfather was one of the most senior Nazis. Even those most senior Nazis, such as Mengele, for example, came back for the death of his mother, I think, when it was her funeral. Hmm. So, and he was able to travel as himself. So you can, yes, this is surprising. And many of these people lived without changing their names in Brazil as well and in other Latin American countries. So, and I think what we have to understand today, it's hard for us to understand this, but what we have to understand about that time is that first of all, intelligence, German intelligence, French intelligence, many of these organizations were actually filled with people who had worked in the Vichy regime or in the Third Reich. Certainly the German Foreign Service was full of people who had served the Third Reich, and they were, they would have to be quite self-critical in order to pursue such people or identify them. So that's one of the reasons why it was actually most of these people moved around with ease. And I think we should also remember that of the thousands of former SS who went to Latin America in the post-war period, only six of them were ever prosecuted. And with great difficulty. And then there are all sorts of reasons for that have to do both with the way that Latin American dictatorships behaved and also the reluctance of West Germany and other European governments to pursue them. Even the United States wasn't that eager to pursue too many of them.
Right.
Because for many reasons, one of them being, I mean, as far as Brazil is concerned, that the United States was more interested in having Brazil as a bulwark against what they saw as the spread of communism in the world than in, you know, making a lot of trouble and fishing out former Nazis who were living in Brazil.
Yeah, and no one's hands are completely clean in this. Our NASA program with Operation Paperclip was powered by Nazi science. So the Saturn V rocket is a more technologically advanced V2 rocket. So there you go.
Yes, and I think overall we also need to remember, I mean, we have in the post-war era, we have the international community has worked quite hard on advancing the cause of human rights in the world. This was, you know, this was underway at that time. People's perspectives about what was necessary in order to have justice was perhaps different to how we see it today. Hopefully, we're not going downhill with our standards of human rights. There is that danger at the moment in the world. You know, I would say on the whole, the perspective of who needed to be brought to justice and why was different then than it is today.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. All right. Well, thank you for that overview. That really sets the stage well for someone who wouldn't know all these figures and these programs going on. Your book really gets into the personal side of the story. So could you tell me, what were your motives for starting your research? Did it begin before 2010 when you found this information in the archives, or is that what kicked it off?
No, my motives go back quite far back. In fact, as far as I can remember in my life, you know, many families have secrets. I would say most probably have some sort of secret, but in mine, it was the nature of the secret was special and heavy. And I think as a young child, you can sense it when there's an elephant in the room and no one can talk about it. And people get angry at one another at family gatherings, and you just can't figure out why. And I think my mother was very frustrated by this, having to carry this burden, and, you know, could occasionally get quite angry about it. And instead of turning her anger towards her parents, who were, after all, the people who were responsible for this, she could get quite frustrated and angry at her children. And so I think I sensed this from a very early age and you know, bore a sense of shame from a very early age without really knowing what that was about, simply feeling that I had done something wrong without knowing what it was. So you could say that this went back a very long way. And but as the years went on, and I, as I mentioned earlier, I got an education that was quite specific to researching this history. And, you know, I had these long conversations with my grandmother, who never relinquished her ideology. So though I loved to be with her in those moments when she toss out shards of her old ideology, I really didn't know what to do, because, you know, I wanted to continue to love her and receive the benefits of her affection. But at the same time, I knew what she was telling me was wrong. So it goes back a very long way. And I would say that the things that brought me to the German Federal Archives in April 2010 were a concern about how this continuation of the state of affairs in our family would play itself out in the next generation. So I have twins, and you know, I didn't want them to go around with the same sense of shame, and I certainly didn't want whatever it was that was infecting our family to infect relationships in my new family. So it really was, I was in a state of desperation and wanted to try to understand how whatever the history was, I wanted to understand it and then try to figure out how it had impacted our relationships.
I have a question about what you said, that your grandmother still held on to her ideology. What does that mean to hold on to an ideology when the army and the government that supported it, the Third Reich, collapsed? It utterly failed. One would think that National Socialism has been completely discredited. So what did that look like with her?
Yeah, you have to wonder how it's possible to do that with those facts in mind, and the fact that the entire country had been brought to ruin, was more or less leveled. Well, what it looked like was that, many of these conversations are also portrayed in the memoir, so I'll go back to them. I mean, it really was that she took a revisionist approach and claimed that the Holocaust hadn't actually taken place, and that this was simply an argument that was made by the global media after the war to keep Germany down. So remember that my grandmother was born in 1912 and had lived through two world wars. And the First World War, you know, she was in her formative years in the aftermath of the First World War. And indeed, at that time, the victors did try to keep Germany down. They imposed very harsh conditions on Germany, which, as we know, resulted in dire economic conditions in Germany during the 1920s. But she used this as an argument to claim that the Holocaust hadn't taken place. Now, I don't know if she actually believed that or not, and I can, at some point, she must have known that this was not right, because after all, she and her husband were stationed throughout the duration of the war in 1 hour. Well, first of all, they were stationed in the middle of, all these camps and this kind of experimental place of the SS, where they were killing so many people and waging their racial war. At the same time, I think that at some point, a lie that you've told enough times becomes your new reality. I think we see that today among many people, the whole business of alternative facts and so forth. So I think this became her new reality, and she freely shared it with me. She was also quite disparaging about people from the East. So she retained her racial views and believed that Slavs were degenerate. So, for example, when I stayed in a hotel in her neighborhood run by Eastern Europeans, she wondered how I could possibly stand it, because it must be awful and dirty and so forth. And she had a belief that was very, it was very characteristic of a Nazi perspective of the world and how things were, which is that nature was this. She tried to dispense with religion, at least her Christian religion, and replace it with a kind of religion of nature, in which her belief was that the strong had the right over the weak, or whoever she perceived to be weak. And this is a very fascist idea, you know, that we should simply let the weak die out. We shouldn't have a compassionate approach to things, because that's not the way nature works. Basically, nature just weeds out what doesn't deserve to survive. So, for example, she would be constantly coming up with examples of this, such as people who have, you know, AIDS should simply be allowed to die. People with mental health problems should be relieved of their misery and things like that. These are very, Nazi ideas, and they were for me. It was I wanted to stand up and scream. A lot of the time, but I didn't, because she was my grandmother, and I wanted to maintain a good relationship with her.
Yeah, thanks for describing how complex complicity can be, because I think we would all like to assume that with the Holocaust, it was the good people on one side and then mustache twirling villains on the other side, and there's no gray. But a system like that, that's so expansive and far reaching, couldn't work if there wasn't mass participation. And I lived in Turkey for many years, and I met so many wonderful people, kindness beyond belief, who were fully convinced that the Armenian genocide never happened and had an answer for every objection. And I didn't even bother trying because, well, what was the point? And not to excuse anything, of course, but it's more complicated than I think we would like it to be. And could you describe the process of putting this all together? So you first encountered sources at the German Federal Archives, and then you went to other archives, and you even found sources directly from your grandparents. Could you describe that process?
When I went to the German Federal Archives, I was informed that they had about roughly 100 pages about my grandparents. And of course, I was stunned because you can't expect to find that sort of information, because the Nazis were extremely good at destroying their own documentation. What I was eventually presented with were documents that pertain to their applications to join the SS as a married couple. So you had to, the objective of those applications was to demonstrate racial purity. The SS were regarded as the elite and the future elite and the ones who would spearhead the new society. And they were expected to give birth to a lot of children and, you know, build up the strength of the nation in that way as the Nazis saw it. And so their applications had family trees going back to 1800 and photographs taken of them from all angles to show that they were, you know, had the right shaped heads and looked like the right sort. Also contained my grandfather's party card, which showed all of the places where he had served in occupied Poland, which is, of course, quite helpful. Because that gave me some idea of where I needed to go next, but I would say the hardest part of that documentation for me to look at and swallow was actually the sight of my grandmother's handwriting, because I had received so many birthday cards and loving letters from her over the years, and you know. She had filled in a lot of forms and written up a description of her life up to that point, which she was required to do as part of the application. And for me to see her handwriting there and to recognize it was so bewildering, so disorienting, and also was, you know, all the time in my mind I was thinking, well, perhps it isn't them, you know. My tendency was to try to be in denial, but when I saw her handwriting, I realized that there was no denying that these were their documents. So with that initial information, I consulted with some academics who told me that I really needed to get to the Institute of National Remembrance in Poland, and particularly their branch in Poznan. But in order to apply to receive whatever documents they had about my grandfather, I actually had to get a hold of his death certificate. So I had to demonstrate that he was dead. And the problem was that his death certificate was buried somewhere in some archive out in Brazil, because he had died in Brazil in 1976. And I don't know if you know anything about the Brazilian archives, but they're not very well organized.
I've been in some disorganized archives, so I can sympathize.
Extremely difficult to find anything like that. And actually, in the end, we found, so I managed through a U.S. professor who put me in touch with a graduate student of hers who was based in Brazil, to find this birth certificate buried in a town, town files or public files of a town on the border between Paraguay and Brazil. So it really was incredible that this student managed to find this document. And with that, I could apply for the documents in Poland and was presented with a in Poznan with a wad of documents which confirmed that my grandfather's extradition had been sought by the Poles, by a local Polish government, and that there were eyewitness accounts by Poles who had worked on his estates, and these accounts were recorded in 1946. And they were pretty detailed, and I couldn't read them at first because they were in Polish. So some Polish friends of mine translated them eventually. But the names of families who had recorded these accounts were there, and so I thought I must go and find them. And fortunately, the young Polish archivist who had been put in charge of giving me these documents decided that this was a, you know, one in a million chance to go and research what he called the real history. So he made himself available at no cost, privately, of course, this wasn't through the archives. He just decided this was a really worthy project and accompanied me through the countryside trying to find people. And actually we, on different visits that I made to Poland, we found five different families, and were able to speak to people who remembered my grandfather very well. In fact, some of them remembered both of my grandparents very well, and painted a fairly consistent picture of an ideologically fanatic SS man. It was a very demoralizing time, I must say, to listen to those accounts, but I think quite necessary to listen to them. And I also, in between the trips to Poland, did some trips to northern Germany, to the towns west of Hamburg, where they had lived before the war and to which they returned after the war. That was a very eerie experience too, because I assumed that Germans who have done probably more than any other people in the world to try to come to terms with this past were at a family and community level were quite sheepish about talking about this period of history and about specific persons, and so I found myself being handed accounts and little brown paper envelopes, and people whispering around me, some people turning me away, and sometimes would find that in the annals of these various towns, this particular, the whole period of the Third Reich just simply wasn't covered. It was just a black hole in the annals of some of these towns. So that was an odd experience. Eventually, in 2014, I thought that, I mean, my resources had run out because I had financed all this myself, but I knew I needed to get to Latin America so that I could research how my grandparents got there and what their lives looked like there. Just as I was running out, my alma mater, Wellesley College, stepped in with a fellowship, and a very substantial fellowship, which made it possible for me to travel to Brazil and, as it turns out, to Paraguay, where I discovered a branch of the family I hadn't known about before. It was actually my uncle who remembered the occupation, was able to tell me something about his experience of that. And in Brazil, I went to archives in São Paulo and Rio and Campo Grande in the interior, and also managed to travel into the interior and find at least the first place where my grandfather had settled after he'd fled to Brazil. So that's a rough look at what it's – that's a rough outline of what it looked like.
Right. A couple of questions. First of all, you were given information in the brown envelopes. What sort of information did you receive? And also, you said that people had vivid memories of your grandfather, that he said he was very committed National Socialist, but you also wrote that they thought he was a good farmer. So what was that about?
We'll start with the brown paper envelopes. At some point, the mayor of one of the towns where my grandfather had settled after the war, tried to gather together information from the town citizens about my grandfather. And so there were accounts, really, of his behavior after the war, which characterized him as being a former member of the SS elite who had, you know, he purchased a hunting house after the war and turned it into a hotel. And so the townspeople said that, you know, former SS would descend on this place on designated hunting weekends, and they would mingle with one another and discuss old times and generally hang together, because you have to remember that after the war in the new democracy, I mean, they had for what, nearly, I mean, throughout the duration of the Reich, most of them been the elite. They were used to being on top, and now all of a sudden they weren't. And in fact, the very qualities, the very roles and ranks that had put them on top of the society now had to be hidden. And so, of course, for them, it was kind of a boost to get together on these weekends. And also, they helped each other practically as well. So I mentioned that one of the people who came to my grandparents' hunting hotel and visited was actually the former SS who was their link in Brazil and helped them to find a place to go. The other things in those brown envelopes, I mean, it was really painting a picture of somebody who had been damaged by the war. You know, he had been stationed in, as I said, in one of the most violent theaters of that war, and he was very affected by that. So, you know, it's somebody who always had slept with his revolver next to him, who once, you know, shot at somebody who was trespassing over his property, and who generally had an extremely volatile temper. So really painting a picture of somebody who was both, who had both been ruined by the war, whose personality had been really destroyed by all the violence, as well as somebody who continued to mix in those former elites. And I also found out quite important as well, evidence to demonstrate that my grandparents actually were leaving because they were afraid of being prosecuted, not just they were leaving for the sun and a bit more land, which is what I was told. So an important piece of information was that they, soon after the capture of Eichmann, they actually put their property on the market for a fraction of the price that it was worth. And you have to remember that this property was you know, prime property west of Hamburg. It was a land with forest and a very fancy mansion on it, which served as a hotel. So it wasn't just some sort of shack. And he wanted just to get rid of it as quickly as he could. And this raised suspicions among the townspeople. Why was it that they, well, of course, they knew. They seemed to know why he was dropping everything and leaving at that time. So that's what was in there. And your other question was about, sorry, if you just give me a quick reminder.
Oh, yeah. People mentioned he was a good farmer. And the reason that stuck out to me is I'm from Iowa. I have farm family on both sides.
Yeah.
In the mid-20th century, to refer to a man as a good farmer in a semi-rural or small-town environment is just about the highest praise that you can give someone.
Yeah.
That's not thrown out flippantly, so I was surprised to see that.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised about it, too. Actually, that was something that one of the people who was a descendant of somebody who worked on my grandfather's estates in Poland, in occupied Poland, was actually what one of those people came up with, that he was a good farmer. Yes, it was high praise, but at the same time, I think you have to put it in context. I arrived there probably looking very ashamed and guilt-ridden and bewildered, because I had also come from several other meetings with people who had described, just stomach-churning violence toward the way that my grandfather had tortured people. And so I arrived probably looking very, very guilty is the wrong word, but looking quite ashamed. And one of the things that some of the people who I talked to and some of the descendants I talked to in Poland tried to sometimes say things that would probably alleviate my, my sense of shame. And actually, I'm sure that he probably was a good farmer. He probably knew a lot. He probably was very skilled. By all accounts, he was very ambitious, and he really wanted to be not a farmer but an estate manager, because you have to remember that in occupied Poland the Germans didn't do the work. He just oversaw the estate, and it was the slave labor that did the work. So I think that it was partly trying to make me feel better. At the same time, they probably really meant it, that, well, he was a dreadful person, but he was skilled. And which led me to reflect on the circumstance, what a difference the historical times we live in and the social circumstances we live in, what a difference that can make. I mean, what if he had lived in another time? Mm-hmm. He might have been just simply an extremely successful farmer. So I think it is quite important to have those, listen to those, not reject those balancing features and qualities, because otherwise there is always this danger of painting people as pure evil. I never do that, because otherwise we have absolutely no reason to try to understand how it is that they end up doing what they do. Right. We can just put this evil label on them and file them away. They have nothing to do with us. They're not like us. They're not even human. And I thought this good farmer story was a great example of seeing the full person and portraying, the complexity of human beings. We can be very good at some things. We can show lots of affection at one moment, and in another moment, we can strike someone down.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Well, in your research and talking to locals, you also went to Latin America, Brazil, Paraguay. You mentioned that mm-hmm. you found family you didn't know about, and they had a very different mm-hmm. attitude toward World War II and the Nazis. What was that like?
Well, I wouldn't say all of them did. It was really my uncle, so my mother's brothers, my grandmother's oldest child, her son. My uncle had lived in Latin America since his mid-20s, and he was over 80 when I met him. And I think his attitudes very much reflected the quite different perspectives of World War II and the Holocaust to be found in Latin America than in Europe and the United States. First of all, the Holocaust seemed very far away to people living in Latin America. And secondly, the military dictatorships that had governed there were ideologically, aligned with the fascists. And so my uncle, and this was, of course, part of the reason why so many former Nazis felt comfortable living there. And I think my uncle, though one can certainly not accuse him of being a fascist or a Nazi or anything like that. He was a child at that time. He was 10 years old when the war ended. His attitude toward former SS, for example, and what his father had done, his father's role, was very affected by the environment that he lived in. And that is to say that former SS were often respected in Brazil, because they were seen as strong men who were organized and who were quite skilled. And as we've just been discussing, often they were quite skilled, such as having estate management or farming skills or engineering skills or something else. Just as an example of how respected they were, the former head of the gigantic province of Brazil that my grandfather settled in, the Mato Grosso, a man called Filinto Miller, he had actually visited the Third Reich in 1937 on the invitation of Heinrich Himmler, and thought that the way the SS, and in particular the Gestapo, had organized themselves was so superior that he wanted to bring some of those techniques and some of the, you know, that or that management style, so to speak, back to Brazil and back to his police forces, which of course resulted in torture being regularly used. So the SS were regarded as perhaps not quite heroes, but they were regarded as valuable, and they were regarded as people to be respected. And there was a little bit of that in the way that my uncle spoke. And there was one episode that I just wanted to recount, because I think it provides good insights about what we're speaking of here. My uncle presented me with a thick book that he claimed was the only thing his father had left to him. And this was a history book written by a revisionist called Paul Carell about Operation Barbarossa. Now, my grandfather had read that book, according to my uncle, something like 15 times. And inside the book, I could see had underlined all sorts of passages, which were explanations as to the tactical and strategic mistakes that Hitler had made in the invasion of Russia. Really, you know, when I looked at this, I felt so mortified, but at the same time tried to set that aside and think, well, okay, I see what this is. There was no thought about the costs of the war or the human cost of the war. The focus really was on why it was that Germany didn't win. What were the strategic and tactical reasons that Germany didn't win? That was it. We deserved to win. And so what were the small mistakes that we made? It was that type of attitude. And my uncle sort of had a bit of that. You know, he said, well, you know, imagine if we had won, we would have had all this land in the Ukraine and it would have been great. And I would kind of stop him in his tracks and say, yeah, but what about the Holocaust? And he'd give a very short answer to that. He didn't deny it. He acknowledged that it was a bad thing, but a bit like that sort of, well, that was a bad thing, rather than that being the primary focus. And I think that attitude is a reflection of the way that people where he was living processed that period of history. So quite different to what we're used to.
That's interesting. It sounds like the first one to two generations of Civil War historians, many of them Southerners, who would say, well, Robert E. Lee was a tactical genius and the South should have won, but due to mitigating circumstances over which we had no control, we lost, but we should have won. So that's interesting. It sounds like it's tapping into that same kind of sentiment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, I'd like to jump ahead a little bit and talk about reverberations and what it meant to look at this family history, how it changed both your perspective, but then what it meant to make known this history that I think for many decades there were attempts to try to keep it silenced or to explain it in a much more rosy way. What was that like?
Well, I would say that the consequences for me were very many, and they're still unfolding, I would say. It really, as far as I'm concerned, it can completely changed my perceptives of, you know, of myself. I had, ever since, you know, I could remember, as I mentioned earlier, lived with a feeling that I'd done something quite wrong. I just didn't know what it was. And All of a sudden, I realized that well, there might be things that I've done wrong, but there's nothing that is so wrong that I've done that I should have felt this way for such a long time. So, really, I think what my understanding of that feeling is now that there was a what I call in the book unclaimed guilt. So the generation that should have taken responsibility for what happened at that time didn't. You know, there's a character in the book who says, provides a phrase, if we don't seek the truth, unclaimed guilt will do its unholy mischief. And that's exactly what happened. I suddenly became freed of this feeling, and that is a very, very major happening. And when you are freed of that feeling, you can actually start to, instead of feeling shame, you can start to feel a sense of responsibility. And of course, a sense of responsibility is a much more fruitful and proactive way to feel. You can put your energy to things that are productive. And so today I do an awful lot of things that I'm motivated to do as a result of this past. A lot of those things have to do with standing up for, you know, defending democracy, explaining to people why it is that we need to defend democracy and develop it, working with human rights related projects, and working within education, for example. So it's really changed things for me. I can also say that it's had consequences for others around me as well. You mentioned my Paraguayan family. Well, I also found that I have Paraguayan cousins. So my uncle has children who are adults, and they had lived with exactly the same feelings as I had. You know, we didn't know each other at all. In fact, we knew nothing of one another's existence until I turned up in Paraguay. And their feelings about themselves mirrored mine, which was fascinating, that the same effects could be felt by others living with this history buried in their families. And you know, in families where it wasn't processed, it wasn't dealt with, and they claim that this was in a way a freeing for them as well. So it's a very facing history like this is a very powerful force for transformation. And I like to say that the book that I wrote, while it's partly about the discovery of a dark family secret, it's actually, to me today, mainly about something completely different. It's actually about dealing with the question of how we transform our knowledge of the past into a force powerful enough to take another path, which is, after all, one of the things we'd like the study of history to result in.
And I definitely want to follow up with you on that question. Before we do that, I want to know about the family reaction, because you mentioned that there were mixed reactions and they were largely divided along generational lines. Could you describe that?
When it comes to the grandmother, so the generation that committed the crimes, I did actually raise with my grandmother at the end of her life when she was over 100 years old what I knew, because I didn't want to be untruthful to her as she had been to me. You know, I wanted to be open with her about what I knew, and I tried to do it in a manner that was not blaming her, but rather simply trying to acknowledge what had taken place. And her reaction was to reject it and to accuse me of creating all kinds of problems in our family and so on. So that wasn't a very, it wasn't a very, it wasn't productive for her, but what could one expect? She was over 100 years old, and the chances that she would take the opportunity to change her mind or acknowledge anything was really quite slim, because it opens up. I mean, I think what one has to remember is doing that would open up an existential crisis. You know, suddenly you would have to, at over 100 years of age, face that you had been involved in this, you know, black hole of human violence. But I would say that the next generation is different again. Their reactions to this are mixed. Some welcome it because they, after all, suffered too. They had to, at the same time as work in their parents' businesses after the war, and at the same time as trying to remain loyal to their parents and their family, had to go to school and, you know, see the films that were mandatory to watch in German schools of what was found in the camps and all the piles of bodies that were found in the camps after the war. And you can imagine the confusion and the complete sense of bewilderment. What were they supposed to do with their feelings? Some of them welcome this work. Others don't welcome it or even reject it and claim that it's false. And no matter what I come up with, it's false. And there's nothing I can do about that. I must say that I don't think it's right to reject facts and to reject the realities of history. But I think I can have some sympathy with the dilemma that generation found itself in. And then when it comes to my generation, I found that when I first printed up the first version of The Pendulum, which was actually half of the current book, so I was out already speaking about this story and thought it might be a good idea to have some copies of the book with me, or a book with me. So I wrote a shorter version than what has just recently been published. And my cousins all wanted to have a copy of this because they wanted to try to understand why they had had poor relations with their parents, or at least some of them had poor relations with their parents, not all of them. And so for them, it was, as I explained to you earlier with my Paraguayan cousins, there were other cousins as well. It was a sort of freeing and hopefully will open up an opportunity for better communication with our parents before they're gone.
Thank you for sharing this whole story. And to wrap up, I'd like to ask a really big question that you hinted at earlier. And that is, it's lazy and kind of simplistic to think there were good people and there were evil people. And we can look at the world in this, you know, sepia-toned World War I type of memory where it's brave American GIs storming the beaches of Normandy, and that's it. Those are the good people, and the bad people were mustache-twirling Nazis. And this question, what came to my mind of how do you not completely write off ancestors who did terrible things? Can you find ways to redeem goodness in them, even though their actions were attributed to something terrible? And what came to my mind is the argument in the United States about Confederate war memorials, where those in the communities would say, well, we're not celebrating slavery, we're celebrating the chivalry and the patriotism of these people. And then critics would say, well, no, the war was fought for the purpose of slavery. So whether you like it or not, that's being celebrated. It's a thorny question, and I don't know if I'd have a clear answer, but did you come away with anything along those lines?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think that on the one hand, we have to continue to make progress on human rights. This is very important from so many different points of view. If we don't try to pursue a direction that is constantly increasing our humanity, we also won't be able to get along with each other and deal with very serious problems that humans are confronting now, such as climate change and our environmental problems. So I think it's extremely important that, you took the example of the Confederate statues. I mean, I think it's extremely important that we acknowledge the realities of what that war was fought over, and that perhaps the best place for those statues isn't wherever. Maybe we shouldn't destroy them, but we should perhaps think a bit more about what their significance is by today's standards of human rights. Then back to the issue of how we see people. like my grandfather, for example, who were very committed to their cause, who really believed in what they were doing, and hurt an awful lot of people, and by some people would be labeled as evil. Well, I think I want to give you a little story to answer the question, because I think it sums things up quite nicely. At some point in my research, I thought I need to find out about my grandfather's early life, because I don't believe people become this way for no reason at all. I think there are a lot of factors that come into play in a person's life that cause them to make certain decisions and cause them to, you know, fall into an extremist movement in this case. And some of those can be very personal and very individual, and some are more common and responding to, you know, overall events in the society, which are better known. So I found my grandfather's birth certificate buried in an archive in the city of Hamburg. And in the left column of that birth certificate, the midwife who had delivered him had scribbled quite an extensive story in handwriting, in which she explained that the mother of this child had given birth to him in her area of Hamburg, which is a poor industrial area of Hamburg, and had left the child there. So she wasn't able to care for it and left the child with this midwife, who looked after him for the first 4 years of his life. And it turns out that the reason that she had left him was because she was from, the upper middle class, and the father of the child was from a lower class. And in the extremely hierarchical society of Wilhelmine Germany, their marriage wasn't condoned, and this child was regarded as a bastard. Now, if you were an illegitimate child in that society, quite a few doors were closed to you. And it isn't really difficult to imagine that somebody born with this label at that period time in history, so my grandfather was born in 1905, might have responded very positively to a movement that said, we're going to have a new elite, and you can easily become part of it. Just join. Hmm. You'll be on the top of the pile. Right? Things like that, these are not things that are incomprehensible or impossible to understand. We have to go into the individual human stories, and that's why this history is never going to get old, because there are so many individual human stories that haven't been told and are unknown. And that's one of the reasons I went very deeply into both of my grandparents' stories to really understand, so what were all these things that got them embroiled in this? There's another story I'd like to share, mainly because it really goes to the transformational aspects of the story that I'd like people to see, and certainly the role that it's played in my life in trying to figure out how to connect what I know about history through this story to, practically speaking, what I do in the future, and what do I do with this story in my life, and how does it affect me, and how does it guide me? When I was tracking down people in occupied Poland, or actually it wasn't occupied when I went there, but in Poland, people who had worked on my grandfather's estates as slave labor. There was one man who I met. He was in his 80s, and his wife and his daughter were there with him to receive me, who I had a very important meeting with that really transformed this old dark story into something else for me. And he invited me into his house. He knew who I was, and he certainly knew who my grandfather was. And I listened to him for about 4 hours, and he shared the most gut-wrenching of stories about what my grandfather had done to his father on a more or less daily basis, namely that he beat him to near unconsciousness, and that he deported one of his relatives, deported his uncle, And all the time when he was relating this story to me, I stared into his face and noted this long black or a long scar over his right eye. And and as he was talking, I didn't ask him, but he related a story so that I realized that this scar over his right eye was a consequence of a blow that my grandfather had delivered to his head with a club or something else when he was a 10-year-old boy, and hadn't doffed his hat when my grandfather had passed him. So if you were a Polish male, you were supposed to doff your hat as the SS passed by. And of course, as I worked this out, I felt absolutely dreadful. And, the tears were on my eyelids, but I held them back because I realized that this guy had gone through much, much worse than I had ever experienced. And when we got up at the end of our meeting, he could see the shame all over me about this. And he grabbed my lower arms and he shook me a bit and he looked into my eyes and he said, "This wasn't your fault and you didn't do anything. Now go out into my garden and experience the beauty out there." And I can safely say that in that moment, that man freed me from the shame that I felt and allowed me to embrace a sense of responsibility and really gave me the energy that I needed to go on with the many years of research that still lay ahead, because I think otherwise I would have just given up. I just simply wouldn't have had the energy resources to do it. And so the reason I relate this story is because I do think that in our societies, shame, whether it has to do with slavery or the Holocaust, shame can be a block, and most often is the block to our facing history squarely and truthfully, and to being able to transform what we know into a sense of responsibility, where we can move forward and make a better society. So that really, for me, is the core of what I am trying to do in this book.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask one more question to tie this in, and that is the lesson of this research, because as we've discussed, it's easy to write people off. It's easy to just say, "Oh, I would never be a Nazi. I would be part of the resistance," you know, as if Nazis back then were like Nazis in America today, which are total fringe losers. And you can argue their influence, but they're definitely not Third Reich levels. So it's hard to resist an enormous movement like that. And we have to realize that. And people died. There are many people who died as a result of their activities of trying to smuggle Jews and Romani, other marginalized peoples. In your research, how would you say we could learn the lessons from the past, have a nuanced understanding, but then also shift course as you hope this research could do with your family and not fall into old patterns?
Yeah, well, that's of course the question. I think that, I'd like to go back to I think you were talking earlier on when we started our conversation about the idea of American exceptionalism, or this kind of idea of people who were victors and people who were losers and so on, and the victors having the moral right and all that. For me, it's been I was given one impression of what my family had been engaged in Poland during the war, which was that they made Poland a better place, and they were, they had beautiful times and they did all sorts of good things for Poles and improved the place. And, I think that sitting there and spending some time with your own family's past and trying to understand it more truthfully can be quite an important thing if more people did it in our society, because it's not so that I hope that most people don't have to make the discovery I did, but I think what you end up doing, just as when you do a sort of genealogical exercise, is that you find all kinds of people, all sorts, people by impacted by all sorts of things happening, that are in your family, that are close to you, and actually that have influenced you. I mean, I have to admit that I have, of course, been influenced by mainly by my grandmother, who I knew very well. And it's in that process that you end up being able to ask a lot of questions about the choices that you make and why you make them, why you react to certain things, why you react to certain people in certain ways, which might not always be, which might sometimes be in a prejudiced way, because all of us bear prejudices with us that have to do with things we've inherited and social conditioning and all that. So I think going back and trying to look truthfully at our own families or our own communities, for example, in an unvarnished way, acknowledging the good people. I don't want to say good and bad people because we want to get away from that. But that you know, there are a lot of different forces at play, and that we are the inheritors. We're the sort of receptacles of all that history. I think doing that and recognizing that will give us a sense of humility and care for the next step, that we won't fly headlong into something or headlong into supporting a new movement that is rash and that that offers simple solutions. Mm-hmm. So to me, what this exercise has resulted in is one of the things it's resulted in for me is always being suspicious of very simplistic portrayals of individuals in the past, mm-hmm. And always being very suspicious of people who tell me they've got a simple plan or a simple solution. I guess that's where I land with it all. But I think we could probably talk about that question all day.
Well, Julie, thank you so much for sharing this and for sharing your story. You are involved specifically in helping people to tell stories for social transformation. And you do a lot of things, mm-hmm. in addition to being a book author. You've done democracy advocacy. So to wrap up, can you tell us where people can find you online and some of the things that you're up to these days?
You can find me at julielindahl.com, so my name. And there you can find out about a number of things that I'm doing. One of the initiatives that has emerged from this work is a collaboration with other authors and creatives to get us out of our little creative studios where we tend to sit all by ourselves and not communicate with other people or the world, and to have public conversations about war, genocide, and peace, but very much focusing on the characters in our stories or the pieces of artwork that we've created. So to try to make it easier for more people to engage in a conversation about the types of questions that we've been discussing, and that broadly have to do with war and peace. We feel that it's a critical time for everyone to be taking their responsibility and to be out doing something. And many of our characters are historical characters, and who really offer a very rich possibility to try to understand the human record and to try to figure out what we might do going forward. So check out New Voices you can access it through julielindahl.com.
Great. And I'll link those things in the show notes so people can check that out. Julie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, Moondoggy from Ohio, and Rick Knowlton, and I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. 3, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free, all 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.